Accession number 7310, rule number 13.
Colonel Cleve, tape 13.
I think we were talking about the relationship of officers and men, I think, or something else. And Captain C.J. Heath, he was a very efficient officer. Did I mention this before? I can't remember. Very efficient officer in many ways and very exacting, and a good disciplinarian when he was at his best, but an extremely difficult person when he was at his worst. And he often, I'm sorry to say, drank too much and lost his temper and got out of control. And even worse than that was on one or two occasions he made an idiot of himself because in the heat of a battle he lost his nerve and we had a job to persuade him to not to run away. I've put it rather crudely. It wasn't quite as bad as that, but he did lose his nerve on two or three occasions when we jolly well had to keep ours under the same situation. So he wasn't a very respected man, and I had a miserable few months while I was under him from that point of view, but I never allowed it to interrupt my duties on the battlefield and or to my men, although I had an awful job to get round his tantrums, which were frequent.
Could I ask you now a little more about your opinion of the generals in the First World War? You have expressed quite clearly your frustration at the sort of lack of mobility and the static thinking. I wonder if you could tell me a little more about your view.
Yes, I think it's probably a little unfair. I know there is an enormous amount of there is quite a large feeling amongst some people that the static outlook of the generals was a ruination of and caused a prolongation of World War I, when had they been more mobility minded, they might have turned a flank or done something useful. Well, certainly the static feeling penetrated all ranks. And on reading my diaries now, I realize how from time to time it affected me, in that during the Battle of the Somme, when we had made ourselves reasonably comfortable in a certain position, I was rather annoyed when we were told to move. Well, of course, I shouldn't have been. But of course, as soon as we moved and we realised the advantage of moving forward, meant that we were overcame one's prejudices, and all was well again. But there was a pervading spirit of static. For instance, I remember there was a well-known 18-pounder field battery just before the Somme, which was so proud of its position that it was well-known as a draw for senior officers' inspections and the press and people like that. What had happened was they had polished all their spades and shovels and guns and spare parts and things and put them all up on the wall of their gun pit, one of their gun pits, And there were these beautiful things with an outline of the shape of them, so that they all had to be in the same place every time they were put back. But the silly thing was they were never used, and their battery was useless in battle because they never wanted to move from that position. So there's, that was the there's quite a lot of that about. So the sense of mobility was rather lost on the whole, and it was very evident in the tank attack on the Somme when there were no cavalry to follow it up. Had there been, I think had the generals then realized that there was any likelihood of the tanks being so successful and the sight of them demoralized the Germans so much that they held up their hands and surrender wherever the tanks appeared, that was a moment when we could so easily have turned off the flank of the Hindenburg line, or comparatively easily, by putting on our cavalry, which would have frightened them even more, although it might have been a dangerous thing to do. On the other hand, sometimes I'm terribly scathing about the static feeling. But one has to remember that it was extremely difficult to become mobile in any way, in that from the beginning, soon after the early movements of the war, and when both armies, after Mons and all like that, Mons and Cambrai go together and loose. Both sides, I think, felt exhausted, and the winter of 1914-15 came, and so they gradually began to settle down and dig in to recover from the early effects of the mobility. Then gradually the static feeling came over everybody. They felt they were safer in trenches. And that happened to both sides. And I think if I criticize the thinking of the high-ups on the British side, I think I should think the same about the high-ups on the German side. As the war progressed, we gradually became more and more mobile because I think we felt we found that the enemy was so powerful that we had to, it was almost impossible to get through their defences, and that was awfully frustrating. And it was that led, of course, to the development on our side of the super heavy artillery and the tanks. And it was, I think, largely due to them that we eventually won the war. So it wasn't a mobile war that we won. It was a static war that we won, which became mobile when we were rather unprepared for it.
Did you ever see the generals at the front? How many times did you see Haig?
I never saw Haig once. I saw General Joffre once, when we were on our first move up from the base in September 1915, and we were parked by the side of a Route Nationale, and the guns on one side and the tractors on another side, and we were all dispersed along the route, and suddenly we saw a cavalcade of cars coming along at an enormous speed in the distance. I remember I stood in the middle of the road and called them to a halt. And out of a car stopped General Joffre. And he said to me in French, "How dare you do such a thing as to stop me, General Joffre, from going along one of my own Route Nationale," and all like that. I said to him, "I'm sorry, sir, but we cannot have a fast movement through our battery while we are parked on the side of the road." With that, in a huff, off he went again. That was one experience. I never saw Sir Douglas Haig, but he was coming to see Bosch Buster on one occasion, but he never did. Lord Horne was absolutely marvellous, a real friend at court, as the GOC First Army, who was thrilled to have been given Bosch Buster and Scene Shifter under his command. And it's a little unfair to blame generals for being static. They minded too much because it was awfully difficult for them to become mobile. But I think the mistake was they should have had mobility in the back of their minds more often. And they should have been constantly aware of the need of somehow to break through the German lines and to become mobile again. So far as horse-drawn transport would allow you to become mobile. There wasn't very much mechanical transport in those days.
Were you able to keep up or get a picture of the shape of the war, how it was going on all fronts at any time? You know, were your communications and was the information good?
I don't think it was as good as it should have been because we only knew really of what was going on in our own immediate neighbourhood. But we were very pleased to hear now and again of news of Russian successes and Romania declaring war on Germany and that kind of thing. So obviously we did get news through somehow. I can't quite remember how it came. There's nothing like as good in World War I as was good in World War II so far as the dissemination of knowledge came. And it will be still more important in World War III because in my mind, if there is a World War III, and I don't think there will be personally, but if there should be one, then I think the soldier, shall I say, in general terms, of today is so much more intelligent and so much better educated than they were in those days that they will question every order that they're given and will be inclined not to obey it if they think it's wrong. Whereas formerly there was no question. If it was an order, you had to carry it out whether you liked it or not. So I think communication was a little bit wanting, and if there had been a successful push, shall we say, by the French army, it came by rumour, which was afterwards proved true, rather than by deliberate circulation. I think I've finished, haven't I? Yeah.
Were you aware in 1917 of the, particularly in November 1917, of the Bolshevik Revolution and the implications of this for the war? Did that strike you at all?
Oh, very much so, because I was at home then, for one thing, and we got the news, as everybody knows, rather quickly. And that was, at first, the feeling was one of devastation. What on earth can we do with all the German troops now facing Russia coming over to face us, to support the present weakened divisions? And it was rather a shock, I remember. But I suppose we must have gradually got over it. Because I can't remember now being the feeling of a sense of devastation. I think by that time the American forces were coming in, and we felt with the power of America behind us, all was bound to be well in the end.
Did you ever see the American troops yourself? Did you have any experience of them?
I can't say I did, or if I did, I can't remember it now.
How about Commonwealth troops? Did you ever meet anyone from the
Commonwealth?
Yes,
well, I had to serve with the Anzac Division because they took over the front on the Somme from us Well, the 36th Battery was situated in September or October, I think it was, 1916, and I found the most friendly, and in fact it was General Curry and General one's Canadian, one division's Canadian, another time it was they were awfully friendly, and we got on awfully well together. And the generals couldn't have been kinder and nicer to us in 36 Siege Battery.
Could I ask you now a little about entertainments at the front? You have mentioned how you had access to the gramophone at one time, and then, of course, in your train you had this lovely piano, which must have been sheer luxury and joy for you. Were there any other entertainments?
Well, not a joy.
Where did you get it, by the way? Can I ask? Your
what?
Piano.
My first piano was given us when Bosch Buster was at his garage de repos in Savvy. And Reginald Tickner, who was my senior subaltern, had been in, he's a bank man, he had been a bank manager in Hadley, Suffolk, Barclays Bank, I think it was. And he's very keen on the opera, Gilbert and Sullivan. And he used to sing very well indeed. And he saw that I was musical. And to my surprise one day, they arrived with a rather decrepit old piano. And I said to them, "Where on earth did you get that from?" And they said, "Hush, hush. We've borrowed it from the RAF." And those of the RAF station only a mile or two away from Savvy Burlett. And they were my subalterns were very friendly with them. They often used to go up there and have drinks with them. I suppose on one occasion they found they had a piano surplus to their requirements, and they let me have it. But not for very long. Anyway, I put it into playing order, and we had some marvellous times when the gun was out of action, and in the evenings when he was singing his most amusing patter songs, and I had to patter on the piano. We had the most amusing time, but then came the day when the RAF insisted on having it back, so I didn't keep it any longer, which was just as well. So I didn't have another piano until after the armistice, when I found myself in splendid isolation with what remained of the battery on the Fond de Vars spur where we fired from first of all, and we were demobilizing there, and time was rather irksome. And it was an awful job to know what to do to employ those men who remained, and they were constantly being sent home, and there were fewer and fewer left, and so on. And so life could have been rather dull, but for me, I did a lot of writing up of the war records, which I produced in a presentable form for the Royal Artillery Institution in the end, which I was glad to be able to do. In fact, every calculation for every round we fired is in great detail in what we call the battery ranging book, which I wrote up very neatly, and that is what they now have in the museum, which I made out in that winter of 1918-1919. I thought, what a pity. Here I am living in a good old French cattle truck, Carondon, Richeveau, with 8 windows in it, because where the ventilators were, we turned them into windows, and one part of the place was the cook room, couldn't call it kitchen, and the other half we've furnished very comfortably with French furniture, which the Germans have pinched and which we pinched from their dugouts, and made it a very comfortable nest. And I thought, oh, here goes, come on, let's have a piano. And I was more or less alone then. All the other officers had gone. And I found out that the YMCA in Arras had accumulated about 50 or 60 pianos. I don't know what they were going to do with it, but as the entertainment places were closed down, they dumped all these pianos in one place. And I was allowed to buy one from them, which I was very glad to do. So I was able to go all around and choose the best that I could find. And I chose the most beautiful Gavot, and this piano I've got in my room now happens to be a Gavot, through no particular choice of mine, but it's a jolly nice piano. And I got a Gavot, a beautiful French upright Gavot, in a lovely case, and bought it from them and put it into this cattle truck. And I had a whale of a time practicing the piano there after the armistice. In fact, when we went down to Dan Camier, Llewellyn and I, and the time was approaching when I should be evacuated home, I had it crated and got permission to have it sent home. It was sent home. My parents had it done up by Maxwell's of Wimbledon, and he kept it for a long time. And it's a beautiful instrument when it was done up. And then they had to get rid of it because we already had two pianos in the house and we didn't want a third.
Was there any organised entertainment during the war that you experienced? Did they put on concert parties, for instance?
Yes, they did. I think the NEF here had a concert party system during the war. Then, of course, the YMCA had concert parties and that kind of thing. But I don't think entertainment was as well organised in World War I as in World War II, when we had SEMA. And that was marvellous because they did send musicians and dancers and opera singers, all kinds of people all over the world to our military centres entertaining the troops. But it wasn't so well organised in World War I. In fact, there wasn't much time for people to enjoy entertainment. The infantry went back to rest now and again, but not the artillery ever. And the poor things, they did need it. And then they got an entertainment, I think, from the YMCA largely.
Of course, you must have been kept quite busy writing your diary. Where did you find time and the place to write up your diary? Was it rather difficult at certain times?
It must have been extremely difficult. Now I come to think of it, and when you ask me the question, I cannot now remember how on earth I ever found a moment of time in which to write up my diaries, or let alone to write home. I think it was for that reason, when I had been taught earlier, before the war broke out, to keep a diary. It was a good thing to do. So, however I found time to write it, I can't think now. All I remember is that I had these diary books, and they all had, as it was strictly illegal to write a diary at that time, they all have locks, and I was very careful where I kept the key. Not that it would have made any difference, however, I did do that. And wickedly, I did keep a diary. I think it may have been when I got back to the battery position, I must have jotted down everything that happened, probably in off moments when we weren't actually shooting. But when I can't ever remember an occasion when I was writing my diary, but I did write them. And largely because when I wrote home, I wanted to quote from my diary, which I did when I wrote to my parents. But it's funny how it's gone from my mind. It was such a routine thing for me to do that I just did it automatically. Whether I was desperately sleepy or not, I wrote my diary up before I did anything else. I think that was the routine that I had, that when I was due to go to sleep, I didn't go to sleep until I'd written my diary. That is what actually happened.
And it wasn't legal. There was a rule against writing a diary, was there?
Diaries were definitely forbidden, because had the enemy captured the position and captured your diary, they'd have got a lot of secrets from it. That was the idea, I think. But I knew that that wouldn't happen, and I took a risk on it. It was very naughty of me. I know it was, and nobody knew I was keeping my diaries. But I managed to do them as I did right up to 1944.
Of course, in those days, there were no biros, were there? And I suppose you couldn't take pen and ink to the front, so hence the pencil use.
I suppose that's what it was, but I think, too, that I never dreamt that the diaries would ever be read by anybody, because I can hardly read them myself now. My writing is very poor, and it was much more convenient to have a pencil to write in. There were fountain pens then. But the bother of doing ink and blotting paper when you were writing by candlelight in any case was out of the question. So automatically I did them in pencil, and now the pencil is so faint I can hardly read them myself. I had to put a magnifying glass over them to read them, some of the words.